Hello, everybody. I'm Dwayne Mancini, and welcome to another episode of Project MedTech. If you need anything from the podcast or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. For more information on Project MedTech, our events we host, our consulting and advisory services, and to sign up for our monthly newsletter, visit our website, www.projectmedtech.com, and follow us on LinkedIn. If you're enjoying this content, don't forget to check out our other podcasts by searching MedTech Money on your favorite podcast platform or by heading to our website. MedTech Money is an interview-style podcast focused on demystifying raising and investing capital for MedTech companies. We have two events coming up this year, our Midwest Showcase August 30th in Cleveland, Ohio, and our Startup Symposium in Houston, Texas, October 25th and 26th. More information on both events can be found on our website and use code PM20 for 20% off. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the law firm of McDonald Hopkins. Building medtech companies the right way based on great technology is not a one-size-fits-all endeavor. McDonald Hopkins provides customized and proactive strategies that align clients' valuable medtech technology with their business goals. This, in turn, builds those clients into successful, thriving companies with strong experience and depth in the startup, venture capital, intellectual property, and fundraising arenas. McDonald Hopkins can be an important part of your team to help you develop the medtech business that you envision. McDonald Hopkins is not only a sponsor of this podcast, but also a sponsor of the Midwest Showcase and the Houston Startup Symposium. In this episode, our guest Isaiah Kaiser at Auxilium Health and I discuss the technology they spun out of the University of Akron, how his PhD helped him with his entrepreneurial skills, finding non-dilutive capital, their experience with the iCorp program, working with the university so that both parties win, what he has learned so far during his early journey of entrepreneurship, and so much more. So without further ado, my discussion with Isaiah Kaiser.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future, what comes next with
Okay, Isaiah, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Dwayne, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, Isaiah, a introduction into who you are, your background, and what you're currently doing with Auxilium.
Yeah, so starting with the background, so I just finished my PhD from the University of Akron, where I studied engineering, really focusing on the mechanical and behavioral side of materials. So I guess from a big picture perspective, I'm really a material scientist. Research-wise, really focused on more of the structural behavior of polymer systems, really actually primarily for the aerospace sector. So a lot of my work involved finding ways to improve performance. I used artificial intelligence, machine learning, and stuff like that. But again, it really focused on the material side. And just finished my PhD in April. Throughout that journey as a PhD, I stumbled upon this entrepreneurial path and these opportunities. And that's really when I was introduced to my co-founder, Aparna Agarwal. And we met back, I believe, in 2021. And she comes from a background in polymer engineering, so very, very similar. And together, we have really tried to commercialize her research and her PhD work that she's completed. So from a material perspective, really what Auxilium Health is doing is developing low-cost and really smart biomaterials to fight wound infection as well as support that healing process in really a wide variety of wounds. Really right now we're kind of focusing on more of these hard to heal chronic wounds.
Awesome. And so because our audience is fairly global in nature, the University of Akron is a university here in Ohio, specifically Northeast Ohio. It's probably about 45 minutes south of Cleveland, Ohio. There's a lot of I'm an Ohio guy as well, but there's a lot of universities and colleges throughout Ohio. But University of Akron is known for their polymer science, correct? Can you expand upon that a little bit?
Yeah, no, definitely. The University of Akron is really, I would say, widely known as the number one polymer science and engineering institute in really the world. Coming from, the rubber boom and really kind of progressing. We have Goodyear right here, as well as a various amounts of other companies. So there's really deep history here in Akron for the polymer side in both science and engineering. So from that perspective, we're very fortunate and thankful that we do have that history here, as well as the expertise here that is really, again, one of a kind.
Yeah, awesome. And then something from your personal background. So you said a lot of your PhD is focused in the aerospace sector. We actually had another episode done. It was Brian Dunn and one other guy, and his name escapes me right now, but episode somewhere in the 120s or 130s, somewhere along there. And they were talking about the relation between building software for airplanes and building software for medical devices. It was a really interesting conversation. And so I'm curious from your perspective, I know you're not in the industry technically, but from a PhD perspective, right? You studied aerospace. What has been some of that similarities between, your PhD and studying aerospace to now transitioning to running a med tech company?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So when I started my PhD, I was a research assistant, meaning, I'm funded by some organization. And I was fortunate enough to be funded by a startup based in Silicon Valley that was, of course, an aerospace company. And really kind of getting that feel, not just for the aerospace sector as a whole, but also that fast-paced startup ecosystem and really world. And I remember traveling out to the Valley and Mountain View area to visit this company, and just the atmosphere and how they were moving was really inspiring. And that, I think, actually really kind of kickstart this thought in my mind of, okay, what does that entrepreneurial journey look like for me? And is that something that I could do? So, over the years, taking a deep dive, working with this fast-paced company on a research side, right? The research was very applied. Which I feel like I was fortunate to be able to work in that type of environment, where the research I was doing was very much so directly related to what we were trying to do as a company as a whole. And we think about the material science aspect of behavior at a whole, which I was looking at, and then translating to this medical side. One of the most interesting things that we, really discovered over time is when we would go out and speak to these, companies in the wound care space, go to conferences and attend them, obviously they're asking, who we are. And we say, we're material scientists. And usually when we say that, they start to kind of get quiet because then they don't want to share too much with us, because there's such that, a lot of these products, in the wound care space are developed by material scientists. So that correlation for us wasn't really crazy on, translating from, our work and then moving it into the medical field. So from an aerospace perspective, obviously we're dealing with FAA instead of the FDA. So two different animals. I'm not really sure which one's worse. aside from the actual technical stuff that we do, I think at a whole, research can be very, very hard, and doing a PhD can be very challenging as well. And, I think it teaches you a lot of aspects, whether it be just time management, whether it be, working in very high, stress environments to where there's a lot of urgency, or, other players that are involved in what you're doing, right? Whether it's, grant companies or industry sponsored companies. So, you know, I think from that aspect, it really taught me how to be efficient in working in these types of environments, as well as, again, you know, being very diversible, you know, and being willing to adapt and deal with failure, right? You know, I think research is so much of just, you know, failing over and over and over and over and over again. And eventually you fail a little bit less, right? And then you know, try to publish that. So, you know, I think at a whole, it taught me so much. And, you know, being someone who wasn't planning to go to grad school, I was going to do my undergrad, jump out into industry and really kind of set in and start working. You know, I was just talking earlier today with someone about really just how that decision and really that first step that I took, which, you know, some can talk about it as a risk, right? You know, I had job offers, and then, you know, I kind of took the step to grad school, but, you know, it's paid off a lot. And, you know, aside from just the degree and publications and everything else, you know, just from a development standpoint, I think it's, you know, really been instrumental.
Yeah, I love that you brought up the problem solving ability, right? And exactly what a PhD necessarily means, because I think in the community, for people who don't know or haven't been through a master's or a PhD program in the sciences, they probably have some misconceived opinions on the program and what it means, right? And so, you know, I have a master's of science in medicinal chemistry, and what you just said is what I bring up every time is, hey, what'd you get from that master's, right? I got 1 year extra of coursework, right? And that's the same thing with PhD programs. You have one extra year of coursework, right? Where you might take in a chemistry program, you might take advanced organic chemistry or advanced biochemistry, or you do some of those things. But then what it really comes down to is it's your ability to solve a problem. Mm. And that's what I tell everyone. That's all my master's degree really taught me, was the fact that I learned how to maybe not pick a problem, but more, you know, kind of given a problem-ish, right? But then how to actually dissect that and figure out how do we get to a solution, right? So I love that you brought that up. I think the other thing too is the failure, 100%. I mean, I can remember the most frustrating period I've ever had in the lab was as an undergrad, where we were trying to functionalize carbon nanotubes. This would have been like 2010, when carbon nanotubes were the hot thing. And good Lord, I can't tell you how many times we couldn't figure it out. And it was so frustrating. Mm. And I'm sure it was more frustrating for the PhD student that I was working under at the time. And so I think that's, you know, when I look at, I think I have a different perspective on it. But when I look at PhDs or master's degrees in the sciences, to me, that's exactly what I go to. I love that they're technical experts, but for the most part, I look at them and go, they understand how to solve a problem. They have patience and they understand failure. Mm. Right. And those are really, really good things. And so I'm glad that you kind of brought that up. Something that's interesting is, so you mentioned you're a PhD. You also mentioned your co-founder Aparna is a PhD, and it's actually her technology that you guys are kind of commercializing here. It's pretty unique to have two PhDs who are CEO and CTO. It's not rare to have a PhD, obviously, as a CTO, but tell me about your transition, you know, from, I mean, you started this company a little bit ago, so you were finishing your PhD program, but you're also having to put your business hat on whenever you're thinking about Xilium. So tell me about that transition for you.
Yeah, it's still occurring. that's for sure. No, but yeah, when it was interesting, because, you know, when I had this thought and kind of, you know, passion start of, okay, you know, what does this journey look like for me? And back in 2021, I remember I was on vacation over the summer, and one of my advisors calls me and he's like, you know, Isaiah, there's this project that I want you to work on. I think, you know, you'll be great. you know, there's some other research, you know, you should come do this. And I'm like, no, don't have time, don't want to. And that was kind of it. And then I think they called me back like a couple days later. And again, I'm still on vacation. And he's like, you know, there's this other student that I just saw a poster for, you know, their work is really interesting. I think there's a lot of potential in it. So, you know, will you meet them? And this person was Aparna. And, you know, at the time, it's like, I said yes. And again, I had just said no to another one. So the reason I said yes, I think is still unknown, because I didn't really know a lot. But obviously, it's worked out to this point. And, you know, I'm extremely thankful for that. But, you know, coming in from this type of mindset, and I guess leadership perspective, is definitely it's different. However, I've never really identified as this type of scientist, researcher type personality, right? My dream was never to work in a lab at a national lab or do that. I love the technical side, you know, obviously, and, you know, that's been the pursuit for such a, you know, large period of my life. But really, when I started, you know, my PhD, you know, I thought of it more as a, an opportunity to, you know, really open up new opportunities for myself, right? To, you know, have different amounts of impact on other people's lives. And I really think, you know, kind of taking a step back and looking at what this PhD has done for me, it has created and allowed for some of these opportunities, right? You know, if I wouldn't have gotten, you know, my PhD, I wouldn't be, you know, sitting here talking to you right now. So, you know, that transition has been different, and I'm learning a ton. And part of my learning process has been surrounding myself with people who have been there and done that. And I'm a huge, huge, huge believer in that. And I see a lot of entrepreneurs burn out because they haven't done that, especially in the technical side, right? We come out of a lab and our focus is doing research. So we get a little money and then we, you know, find a lab, we rent out a lab, and that's where we are 24/7 for 5 months, and then we burn out. So I think, you know, to your point, Aparna and I complement each other extremely, extremely well. She's the smart one, you know. I'm not the problem here. So, you know, she brings that level of expertise, right? You know, and I tell her, you know, she's really a one of one in this area with this technology. You know, for me, I think, you know, not just the PhD, but, you know, other experiences that, you know, I've grown up in, whether it is, you know, sports or even family dynamics, you know, I think all of that's kind of help build me and prepare me for this type of leadership position. And again, you know, like I said, I'm still transitioning, I'm still learning, but you know, I've been very fortunate to know a lot of people that have worked in similar types of leadership scenarios, and I've you know, relied heavily on them.
Yeah, no, that's great. And so, you know, in full disclosure to everyone listening in, and you could find Auxilium's logo on our website, but Auxilium is a client of Project MedTech Consulting, and also a Bounce client as well. So there's a group in Akron, Ohio called Bounce Innovation Hub, where Project MedTech serves as entrepreneurs and residents, and working with all of their health tech portfolio. So I, you know, being involved with Auxilium, I do know a little bit more of the story. One thing that you have done better than a lot of companies that we work with is you have made early non-dilutive capital stretch very far. And you've also done a really good job of finding some of that small non-dilutive checks, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000. So I guess walk me through a little bit about, one, the first question is, how did you find some of these different opportunities, right? Because they are, they're difficult to find, right? I mean, you have to scrub local competitions, things like that. So walk me through how you found those. And the second part of this question is, when I say stretch this non-dilutive capital, what I mean by that is sometimes when we see early stage companies like you are, right, you haven't even raised a formal round yet. When they get non-dilutive cash, it's easy to say, well, I need to put all $3,000 to more research or refining the prototype or doing something like that. And, you know, generally what we're saying is, well, hold on, let's take a step back. Maybe you could split that a little bit and do some business activities to formulate a business plan, which will make you more investable, and also do some of that. So walk me through how you found the non-dilutive capital, but then also how you thought about spending it.
Yeah. So finding the capital in the early stages of Auxilium was difficult, but really it became easier the more tapped in we became to the ecosystem. So, you know, I think that's a really, really important aspect, is trying to, you know, immerse yourself as much as possible in the ecosystem. So, you know, the first thing that we did when we formed the company, we really did two things. We wanted to understand the customer, and then we wanted to understand what value we could bring to the customer, right? And, you know, you can have a lot of value, at least, you know, you think you bring a lot of value, but, you know, does your customer think you bring a lot of value? So when we kind of got that initial feedback and we're like, okay, you know, maybe there is a potential here, we joined Bounce Innovation. As you mentioned, Dan, you and I got coffee. And, you know, we started working with you. And that was really that first move for us, because it's like, okay, we're entering into a space that is pretty crowded. And you know, aside from that, we're entering into a space that, you know, we really don't have that expertise in yet. So, you know, joining Bounce, and as well as our, you know, really good connection with the university, you know, we would just, you know, subtly, you know, get notified, hey, you know, there's a pitch competition over here. But I think aside from that, you know, early on, it's very important that you show that interest, right? You know, sometimes you may, or, you know, you may be fortunate that people are just going to be sending you stuff, right? But it usually doesn't work like that. And you really need to go out, and the connections that you do have, then maybe, you know, have, you know, another connection that's, you know, holding or hosting a pitch competition, or, you know, a small grant that they're, you know, giving away. I think it's very important that, you know, to be persistent there, and to really reach out and, you know, ask your network, because the money's out there. It definitely is. It's just, you know, finding that and preparing for it, I think is difficult. But again, the more you surround yourself and immerse yourself in that ecosystem, the more you're aware of the cycles of these grants, these events, these competitions, in addition to who's hosting them, right? You know, and I think that's a very important component of it, is, you know, familiarizing yourself, not just with the competition, but, you know, those who are actually holding them as well. Now, since our inception as well, I've seen various companies start with the grant cycle and then get stuck in the grant cycle for a long time and kind of, you know, make progress, but they're not moving at the speed that they need to actually commercialize something. And I you know, have been very aware of that. So I definitely wanted to avoid getting stuck in that type of cycle, right? Because coming out of a technical background, grants are amazing, right? Non-dilutive, we get them, we can spend them. However, sometimes, you know, some of these grants are pretty geared towards, you know, the development and the research side. And you can spend all your money there. But, you know, if you're not at the same time, you know, understanding your regulatory pathway or how this product's going to be reimbursed, or even your customer, or, you know, actually building out your, you know, financial model, or milestones, et cetera, you know, whatever it may be, then, you know, you're missing a huge picture of what you actually need. So, you know, us being fortunate to bring in some, you know, of this non-dilutive funding within this last year, we've tried to be very strategic in what moves the needle the most for investors, right? What are they going to want to see? And it's not that we have to have everything figured out, right? But it's, you know, we want to have thought of this, right? And like, okay, well, we're thinking of this, we're working on this, because I don't, you know, you don't want to be in the situation though, you know, where an investor asks you something and you have no idea what they're talking about. So, yeah, we've tried to be pretty intentional and strategic here. Again, you know, I'm not saying the grant cycle is bad, or, you know, dilutive capital is the only way to commercialize. I'm definitely not saying that. I think, you know, these should be and can be pursued in parallel. And, but, you know, obviously if you're only pursuing grants and a grant doesn't come, right, you're 6 months in, you don't have the capital. And then it's like, you know, now what, right? On the flip side, right, you raise, you know, some dilutive capital and then a grant comes in, right? You know, it's not a bad place to be in. So I think, you know, just being very strategic about this, is the best way to go.
Yeah. I love the parallel path piece. You're 100% spot on there. I did want to comment on two things. So, you know, meeting you for the first time and getting coffee at Bounce Innovation Hub, I'm not even sure Auxilium was formed yet. The idea was there, but we were just talking hypothetically about, you know, hey, here's some of the steps you could take. And then I think you probably even joined Bounce before Auxilium was even an entity. But where I was going with this is, I remember meeting Isaiah and coming back to the Project MedTech team and saying, we are going to get a chance to work with a really, really impressive founders team. I hadn't met Aparna yet at the time, but I could tell you that the first impression you made was a good one. And I think to your point about going out and making those connections and being very purposeful about those, right? We see a lot of entrepreneurs who just want to check the boxes there and they don't leave that lasting impression. We meet with a lot of entrepreneurs, right? And I can distinctly remember sitting down with coffee or to drink some coffee with you. The other thing you mentioned was going into the wound care space. It is very crowded, to your point. And I think sometimes that when you hear someone say something like that, that kind of scares them off or it leaves a sour taste. And really what that meant to say is you're going into a crowded space. So we need to be very tactical. Mm. We need to be very targeted. We need to be very strategic with how we approach everything because it is a crowded space. So I love that you brought that piece up. The next two things I have to ask you are going to go in similar yet different directions. Tell me about the iCore program because you went through that. So I'd love to hear your feedback on the iCore program. And then the second piece of that, and probably ties into it, I'd love to, you know, a little bit about, you know, working with the university, right? On grants. So on second thought, tell me about the iCore program, then we'll come back to this, working with the university question, because I'll set that up in a different way.
Yeah. So, really the first thing that Aparna and I did was we did a regional iCore program through the University of Akron Research Foundation. And that one's less intensive. It's kind of giving a preview of this national program. So maybe you need to complete a little over 20 or so interviews. And really that, you know, process of iCore is really going out and doing customer discovery, right? You know, understanding the customer, understanding their pain points, and then really kind of where you can potentially fit in. It's really based on this idea of like the lean launch pad, business model canvas, and really those kind of, you know, key elements, right? Where the lean launch pad really focuses more on, right, customer discovery, development and testing, right? You know, the minimum viable product, and really kind of these basics and decision making, pivoting versus, you know, persevering, et cetera, really, you know, it's really for these very early, early stage. So we completed that regional I-Corps program, first thing we did, and then we did that national I-Corps program, which is a lot more intensive, 7 weeks, I think 100 interviews. And, you know, they have a kickoff period where like the first 3 days are like 9-10 hour days, and it's just constant. And it's intensive, but it forces you to go out and actually speak to the people that you may want to sell with, right? And it's not like through the program you need to learn who you're going to sell with, but you really just learn the process, right? Maybe you have a couple different customer segments, and during the program you focus on one, you know that process, and then you kind of move into, you know, after the program, maybe you go and evaluate another one of the customer segments. So the program is fantastic. Again, it's, you know, really based around this business model canvas and, you know, different aspects, which, you know, customer segments, value prop, channels, customer relations, et cetera, these types of things. And really, you know, more of the customer segment and that value prop, and, you know, understanding if that proposition that you're giving matches, you know, that customer segment, and if that can eventually lead to that product market fit. And that's really that main aspect that we're trying to in somewhat flush out, as well as, you know, how are we actually talking to customers, right? And I think that's a very important aspect, because when you have a technology, you know, you can present it sometimes in a biased way, right? You know, like you present this in a way that you can lead their response. So this was something that they focused a lot on, right? And so when we went out and spoke to over, you know, we ended up speaking to a little over 100 different stakeholders in wound care. We traveled all across the U.S., you know, attending these huge symposiums and conferences. We even went all the way up to Washington State. And we thought it was going to be a bigger conference, but we showed up and there's probably like 50 people there. And they're like, what are you doing here from Ohio? but it ended up being one of the best conferences that we attended, because amazing. It was, yeah. You know, very intimate, and we could ask these more, you know, detailed questions. It's really a intensive but very productive program that, again, you know, really helps lay the foundation, and obviously, you know, helps you evaluate if this is something that is feasible, and you know, if it's something that other people actually want.
Yeah, that's awesome. We've actually had, we have not had him on the podcast yet. We know the Great Lakes or Midwest regional head up in the University of Michigan.
Yeah,
I've been meaning to get him on the podcast to talk about this. Okay, so working with the university, this is another interesting thing that we see with a lot of companies, because a lot of technology comes out of universities or hospital groups or academic research institutions, and so. And something that is very sensitive at the early stage is, you know, a lot of people think, oh, you just got to license the technology and take it out as fast as you can, right? And that's not totally accurate, right? And so you've had a lot of experience in this, but, you know, something we see is the relationship between the company that's going to commercialize the technology and then the continued relationship with that maybe PI or investigator within the university that's going to continue to potentially drive value to the startup company by doing research, right? What I see a lot is the tension between that relationship sometimes builds up, and there's a delicacy to managing that relationship so that everyone gets the value they want out of the research, the relationship, the continued partnership. And it's a difficult thing, right? Because what drives the business value might be different than what's driving the academics mission, right? Mm-hmm. Which could be to publish in journals, or continue to get on podiums for research, where the you know, for the business, I might be like, well, actually, if you altered that research project this way, it would really benefit the company. And there's that delicacy there. You've obviously done a good job with managing that. So I'm curious from your side, you know, what's some of that advice? How do you continue to manage expectations? There's grant dollars that can come in. Just curious how you think about that and think about that ongoing partnership, even once the technology is fully licensed out of the university. How do you continue to build that relationship and leverage it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think this is one of those aspects that coming from a technical background helps, in the sense that, you know, we really appreciate the research and understand the importance of it, you know, not just for our company, right, but for the scientific community as well. We're definitely very fortunate that we are licensing technology, not just from a university that we've come from, but from a lab that, you know, our co-founder has, you know, graduated from. You know, I think sometimes, right, you know, people come in and license technology from a university that they really don't have an affiliation with. And then they're trying to establish that relationship and, you know, build that and understand kind of how does that work going forward. We've been very fortunate with an amazing PI in Dr. Jana, and, you know, really his relationship with us, his understanding support. You know, I think that's, you know, oftentimes not as talked about, but, you know, as a PhD student, right, you need support from your advisor to be able to do and pursue things like this. So, you know, we obviously had support from Dr., you know, Jana, but even from my advisor who isn't involved in this project, you know, he saw, you know, what I was passionate about, and he really let us pursue that. So I think, you know, moving forward and understanding that it's really about just expectations. What we're expecting and what we want, as well as what they're, you know, expecting and their desires. And I think there can be a lot of benefits to both, right? Obviously, you know, continuing to publish, you know, and drive home, you know, the science and the credibility here can provide so much value to what you're trying to do, right? Especially if, you know, this lab is doing it, right? And it's not our lab. Right, you have this university who's publishing work that's validating some of the stuff that we're saying. But even in addition to that, you know, I think there's so much potential for that, you know, collaboration and support from us, right? You know, Auxilium would love to be able to support more PhDs, right, to develop this, you know, more research and drive more grant opportunities, and of course, you know, more students through these labs. So I think, again, you know, really just having a clear understanding of both sides is really just, you know, the most important thing. And, you know, understanding their goals and objectives versus what we're trying to do as a company, I think, you know, is just extremely important. And, you know, once you really get to that agreement and that type of understanding, I think it can really reduce a lot of that confusion or lack of clarity that may arise, or you know, tension per se. But you know, of course, we've been fortunate to have a very good relationship.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to your point, right, it's the one thing you both share is mission and vision, or at least mission, maybe not so much vision. That might be where you differ, right? The vision that you have on how to bring this technology to improve patient lives versus how they feel about it, it could be different, right, in that motivation. So as long as you understand that and go in there with a good mindset, you know, I see these relationships work out pretty well. I will say, again, I have a master's degree, so I feel like I could say this, but where I see a lot of scientists fail is they fall in love with the solution and not the problem. Mm. That is generally, you know, where I start to see it, it's a slippery slope of being very proud of your solution versus, you know, falling in love too much with it and not being able to pivot when needed and that sort of thing. Mm. So, yeah, I love your feedback there. So we're 37 minutes in, and hopefully this has been painted by how this conversation has went. We've talked about your solution for maybe like 5 seconds. And so what I want to do in closing, because I think the advice you've given for really early stage companies, right? Like I mentioned before, you know, Auxilium hasn't gone out and raised a round of financing yet. Your advice so far has been awesome. There's so much to learn about your experiences so far and how you've gotten to where you are. And we could probably talk for 2 hours and expand upon all of these. But I'm curious, where is Auxilium going? And I'd like to use the rest of the time to just kind of chat about that. Is what's next for you guys? Where are you going? And if you want to expand upon the technology here, you know, feel free.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think the next big step for us is to raise that funding round and raise a pre-seed, especially now since both myself and my co-founder are done. And that was really, I think, the thing, right? A lot of this work has been preparation, and now it's time to execute. And, you know, we're definitely excited for that. And, you know, I think your point on, you know, falling in love with the solution instead of the problem is so true. And you know, what's interesting with how our technology developed is we weren't necessarily designing this right for this specific application, right? We had this technology. It was very interesting, very unique. So then we went out and talked to people. And when we started to learn about their problems, then we're like, wait, you know, we think we can potentially solve this, or, you know, wait, we think we can maybe solve this too. And then that's really how this was developed, you know, really based on that feedback. So, you know, yeah, biggest next steps for us are to, you know, hopefully raise some funding to continue to push this forward. But yeah, you know, our technology, to kind of just dive a little bit deeper, when we look at the chronic wound care space, I think, you know, it's understood, right, that it's a problem. You know, everyone knows that wound care is, you know, it's a big market. There's a problem, but I think like understanding the severity of it is still, you know, being, you know, understood, right? You know, you don't realize, you know, how many people suffer from this, or, you know, that those with an amputation that have diabetes have a higher, you know, 5-year mortality rate than some people with cancer, right? You know, so you just see crazy, crazy, you know, statistics here that is really just, you know, extremely, extremely sad. And, you know, when we went out and talked to physicians, the interesting thing is when we did talk to them, we didn't talk to them as founders of a wound care company. We talked to them as students who were just trying to learn about wound care. And, you know, a lot of different pain points came up, right? The idea that, you know, some of these wounds need to be changed, you know, sometimes multiple times a day to deal with this fluid or this exudate that's coming out of the wound, right? And, you know, if you just think about it, right, changing a dressing with a wound that's, you know, you have an open hole in your body, essentially, right? You could have bacteria getting in there. You know, sometimes removing that dressing can be super painful, you know, in addition to a lot of other things. And so, you know, at the core, we were looking at this, okay, well, is it possible to reduce the amount that a dressing is changed? Like, can you actually do that? And then we got the feedback, well, you know, the wounds become infected, right? So, and this is very common. So, you know, how are you going to know if the wound becomes infected? Or there's so much fluid that comes out of the wound, you have to change it, right? You have to change it to manage the exudate, because if you don't do that, then it'll become infected again. And then more recently, this concept of biofilm has, I think, become more widely known and accepted in this space, to where at a high level, right, you know, bacteria is in the wound, the bacteria colonizes and then forms this film on the wound. It matures. And when this biofilm matures, it essentially becomes resistant to antibiotics and other things. So there's almost nothing you can do besides go in and actually scrape this off of the wound. And, you know, that's why physicians do debridement. So we saw all of these different aspects, right? Infection, biofilm, the wound fluid, and, you know, that exudate. And we kind of said, you know, is it possible to kind of solve these, you know, and provide a solution that can be left on longer, you know, not just to reduce the time spent by the medical professional, right, the physician or the nurse, but to actually improve healing, right? You know, can we do this? And that's really what we're trying, you know, to develop. So, you know, our technology does a couple of, we're developing our technology to do a couple of, you know, things. And really at the core, we're trying to manage and hopefully prevent that infection that will occur. Our material is very unique in the case that, you know, when in contact with some of this biofilm, it can actually disrupt it, right? And a lot of these solutions that we see focus on managing the biofilm, right? After it forms, they remove it, right? But our focus here is actually, can we actually just prevent it from occurring in the first place and not kind of manage it afterwards? But I think one of the interesting aspects is we've integrated certain aspects into our material such that it's actively sensing some of the physiological markers of the wound. So, you know, in the case an infection does occur, our dressing will actually visually indicate that with a color change. And this is something that we're definitely very excited about because in so many cases, whether they're, you know, inpatient, you know, outpatient, you know, whatever, this type of data is something that anyone can really see and know. So if a patient is at home and they've been dressed with a wound and, you know, something is starting to change in the wound environment, they can actually see this, similar to, of course, a physician. And what's interesting about this is that assistant, right, or that visual change doesn't necessarily require, right, a dressing to be changed. It's just letting the physician know that something is going on, right? So, you know, sometimes physicians just have to check the wound to see if it is infected, right? So they just change that dressing just because of that, right? And there's really no other reason. So with something like this, we're really hoping this will just provide that data to the medical professional or, of course, to the patient without them actually needing to intervene on, you know, the wound care or, you know, that schedule.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, just from a personal standpoint too. I mean, so much of what you just talked about, right? The you know, the scraping process of some of these wounds. This extends wound closure time for folks months, which is frustrating. When it comes to infections, this is a huge cost to the healthcare system because timing is everything, right? I mean, if you if you've ever seen the leg infection, cellulitis, right? I mean, that is when you talk about the progression of that, what happens in like 6 hours, 8 hours, 12 hours, it's crazy. And so you're hitting on a really strong point here of being able to identify an infection early and hopefully be able to nip it in the bud much sooner than if you let it progress because you don't even know it's infected, right? So I think that's super cool what you're doing there. Awesome. Isaiah, I will have links to Auxilium's website in the show notes, also Isaiah's LinkedIn. Anything else in closing that we didn't get to touch on, Isaiah?
I don't think so. No, this has been great.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining. We'll chat offline here. But thanks again for doing this.
Awesome, Duane. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.